Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we are doing with 6 minutes to go in the Laker-Warriors game two, because we love our colleague at ESPN, Tristan Thompson, but when he came in the game, we thought it was a sign we could begin the podcast. Joining me, this is an all-New York City pod right now. We're all in New York City. Joining me from, how many blocks away are you, Bontemps? About 100?
About 5 miles away on the Upper West Side.
All right, I'm in downtown. And look, we had to make a call tonight. Bontemps and I worked last night at the Celtics Sixers game too.
No. Here's the deal.
he interrupted me already. You haven't even announced who.
You were 14 seconds in. Yeah. Timmy B has already decreed that he's jumping in the.
Well, listen, Brian was going to try to go into.
Listen, Dally. Listen.
That's right. First of all, there's the laugh track. Our buddy Nick Friedel, because Brian needs his beauty sleep. And couldn't wait for Ben McMahon, who had flight issues. So he had to call into the bullpen. And here's the laugh track, giggling.
This is the second time the laugh track has been rolling this week. The first time it didn't go so well. That's the second time it's really rolling.
Well, all I'm going to say is that Bontemps and I worked the game last night. We left the arena after midnight. We took the 6 a.m. shuttle flight to New York to work in the studios today in New York. And tomorrow we both got to go to Philadelphia and I got to be on Get Up, which the first production calls at 6 a.m. So when McMahon's flight got canceled and he wasn't going to land until 3 a.m., we made a command decision that one 4 a.m. Eastern podcast this week was enough. So this is why we got our man, Nick Friedel, in here.
Got the laugh track. We're here to giggle.
Covering the other series, Heat Knicks, and he'll be headed down to Miami tomorrow for game three on Saturday. But first, let's talk about this one. Not what we were all hoping for after that terrific game one. The Lakers got an early lead. Strangely, if I had told you before the game, Bontemps, that, you know, Kevon Looney was going to be compromised in some way, he's ill, he still played a little bit, would you have guessed they would have started JaMychal Green? That's what Steve Kerr did. That surprised me. It looked like it could have been a strategy decision because when the Warriors played small at the end of game one, they had difficulty rebounding and keeping the Lakers off the line, but they did play better. So it looked like it could have been a strategy decision, but Looney was apparently sick. I was very surprised with it, but it worked out really well. They're going to win this game because Klay Thompson went off and their 3-point shooting worked with Steph playing out of more pick and roll. But JaMychal Green, what a move by Steve Kerr.
I guess. I mean, I wasn't a big fan of JaMychal Green starting either. I mean, look, the Warriors won this game because it's the 16th straight time that a team lost game one at home and won game two, including Tuesday when our guy Friedel was at the Garden for the Knicks winning game two against the Heat, including last night in Boston where the Celtics rolled the Sixers in game two. It's just very hard when especially you're in the conference semifinals. You generally got good teams playing against each other, but team loses game one at home. They know the series is over basically if they lose that game two at home. And so they're going to come out with a desperation that's just hard to match. And that's really what happened in this game. I mean, we can go through strategy stuff. I mean, AD again was dreadful as the yo-yo with Anthony Davis continues from game to game, but ultimately the Lakers got what they needed. They got the win in game one. And like the Sixers last night, they can walk out of San Francisco saying, hey, we got a split. We're going back to LA, a place that for whatever reason, the Warriors have never played well, even when the Lakers have been bad. And if they could get two wins there at home, they're going to be in command position in the series.
Yeah. Friedel, I want to compliment the Warriors on the comeback. I don't want to take my focus off of that. We know that if the Warriors, who you used to cover, you know, these guys really well. We know if the Warriors shoot really, really well, they're going to win the games in this series. That's not breaking news. The Lakers leave 1-1. LeBron only had to play 28 minutes. He almost got thrown out of the game. He had a quarrel going on with Tony Brothers, which ended up being the most interesting thing in the second half, I think, the referee. And I think it's, you know, he shot the ball well from the field, hit some threes, which he hadn't hit in the entire postseason. AD didn't play well, but only played 33 minutes. I think if you're a Laker fan, it's not the worst situation in the world.
I just want our boy McTen to have the pool report exchange with Tony Brothers to see how that goes for that explanation. But it'll be, no, I mean, this is exactly what the Lakers could have hoped for. They get the win. They go back. The thing that worried me for the Lakers coming into game two is, guys, we saw those stories. Oh, they extended LeBron and AD. They played them so many minutes. That's the concern if you're the Lakers in this series. It's not that you can stand toe-to-toe with the Warriors. It's we got some older guys. We've got some guys who have become injury-prone, who have stayed on the floor to this point, specifically with AD. Can they maintain the same level they had in game one when you are running around chasing Steph over the course of a seven-game series? It's why I still believe the Warriors will end up winning this series, and I feel confident that the depth they have on top of where Steph is at will shine through, because the Lakers so desperately need LeBron and Davis to play the same way all the time if they're going to win.
Yeah, I mean, look, so AD's got to be the best player in the game for them to win. He was dominant in game one, and he was terrible in game two. And like, now with this series, to your point, Nico, and every other day, let's see if he can have those kind of efforts every other day for 2 weeks, because he's going to have to do that for them to win this series. Like, he's got to play in the way he did in game one, which, by the way, he put up numbers that only Wilt, Shaq, Elgin Baylor, and I think Kareem have ever done with the Lakers. Like, that was an immense performance.
And it came down to the final possession,
right?
Which, you know, right. Which, and the Warriors were home. The Lakers will get an advantage for playing at home. You know, I think Darvin Ham had a really good game plan for Steph. I think one of the things that you hear about Steph is it's very hard to guard him because you never know where he's going to go. They don't have plays per se. They have like process. And so it's hard to guard him. And he relocates so well. And there's such good feel with him and Draymond and him and the other players. But they do know what his tendencies are. And they guarded against his tendencies off the ball. And Steph had trouble getting the ball. And so they put him on the ball tonight. And he had 12 assists in 30 minutes. And it's hard to guard him when he's at the top of the key in the pick and roll. Now, it's more taxing on him, that's for sure. And the reason he had 12 assists tonight was partially because their offense was functional and partially because Clay was unstoppable shooting the three. What was he? Eight of 11. I mean, Steph and the Splash Brothers tonight, Steph and Clay, 11 of 16. Good God.
Yeah, Clay's been due for one of these and finally had it tonight.
Right. So part of the reason he had the 12 assists was because the guys were hitting shots. I mean, Jermichael Green, as I mentioned, he had three threes. He had 15. Just a tremendous performance by him. So I think the adjustments you see right there is plain as day. You know, they're going to have to defend Steph in the high pick and roll. That's going to bring Anthony Davis away from the basket. And, you know, Jeff Van Gundy mentioned this in the game when Steve Kerr has had to change his lineup due to various things, including suspensions. He has tended to stick with that lineup. He doesn't automatically go back. In the last series after Draymond was suspended and they won, he kept Poole in the starting lineup. Eventually that well ran dry and he brought Draymond back for when they needed it. And it worked out. So I would expect to see Jermichael Green in the starting lineup again. You know, the game is still not over yet. We don't know what Steve said, but I expect to see Jermichael Green in the starting lineup on game three in LA over the weekend, Montemps.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what Steve, I mean, I think Nick would agree. That's sort of what Steve's move is. He sticks with what works until they lose a game. That's basically what he did in the Sacramento series. He stuck with that lineup until they lost game six, and then he went back to his traditional lineup in game seven. I mean, we'll see if this was, you know, a Looney illness thing or a lineup adjustment thing. But, you know, the other thing too is the Lakers, you would expect to have a pretty significant free throw advantage in every game in the series. They currently have one less than the Warriors and didn't shoot a free throw till the very end of the first half. If Golden State can avoid fouling and sending them to the line, that's going to be a pretty significant swing LeBron in their favor.
LeBron took no free throws. I don't know. I have to check with stats and info. The last time he had a no free throw playoff game, his free throws have been going down as he's gotten older. But, you know, one of the things he does is he attacks the paint. And in game one, he was definitely attacking the paint, especially.
He looked pretty good. He looked pretty good today too.
Yes, he definitely did. And, you know, not only with the, with the 23 points. But you know, he had 7 rebounds and like, you know, not too many minutes.
To answer your question, LeBron has had 3 games with no free throws ever in his playoff career. Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals in 2007, game 5 of the first round series against the Suns a couple years ago, and game 3 against the Spurs in 2013, all losses.
And he's played 100 some odd playoff games. So
he's played 273.
173.
B, this is a perfect segue because you have told me for 10 plus years at this point, longer than that, I'm never betting against LeBron.
Right.
In a playoff series, I've seen it too many times. LeBron will find a way. I'm not doing it unless...
I'm not sure I thought he'd be still doing this at age 38 when I started saying that, but go on.
Well, so, all right. So this leads perfectly into the question. As I watch this series, as I watch Steph not only in Game 7 against the Kings, but over the course of the last couple of years, I feel like Steph Curry is playing the best basketball we have ever seen him play, which is saying something because he's been so good for so long. I am not betting against Steph Curry in this series. I think the reason why I still feel so strongly that the Warriors will find a way is because they have Steph Curry. Do you feel like that threshold has been crossed to the points that Timmy B just brought up about all the games and the lack of free throws and the times where we just haven't seen him play sometimes at the level that he has maintained for so long? Has that threshold been crossed where you say, hey, I'm not betting against Steph even in a series against LeBron James?
Well, I wouldn't have bet on LeBron in the 2018 finals. So, I mean, it just depends on the quality of the opponent.
That's called a cop-out answer.
I mean, no, I don't think LeBron can beat anybody under any circumstance. I would just say that if I'm going to make an error, I'm going to make an error believing in LeBron more than I'm going to make an error and not believing in him. And I stand by that. What I suspect will happen in both this Warriors-Lakers series and the Celtics-Sixers series, I'm not so sure about the Knicks series because so much of it, I think, rides on Jimmy Butler. What I suspect is going to happen is that the home teams will win Game 3. That Friday night, Joel Embiid will get his MVP. The crowd will be crazy. I expect him to play better than he did in Game 2 when he was knocking off the rust. And I expect them to just get a home win. And I expect the Lakers to win at home. And then Game 4 will tell us what will happen in the series. Because Game 4 is when all the chips will be down. And even though those series will potentially all be 2-2, or obviously 3-1, you have a huge edge. Game 4 will tell us. That's my guess. Just having watched a lot of playoff series, and there could be injuries, there could be a lot of factors.
To your point, when we have these series, like, you know, when the Sixers and the Heat and the Lakers won these game ones, these even number games, when the team has a chance to go up 2 games in the series, those are the best games. And especially that's the case in these game fours, right? Like if the home team wins those game fours, if the Sixers win, if the Lakers win, if the Heat win, you go into game 4 in all those series and the road team has to win the game to get back home court advantage, or they're down 3-1. Right. We saw that with the Grizzlies in the first round. The Lakers the Lakers come back and get that win. It's a great game. Goes down.
What
to
other
end.
Series? What other series do we see it in? Warriors.
And, with the Warriors. Right. Warriors Kings. Right. Warriors come back. Right. Have the crazy ending. Those are the games. And then same with game 6. Right. We saw Jimmy Butler last year. We saw Steph and the Warriors in the finals in Boston win that game 4, you know, come back in the fourth quarter and win. Those are the games. When you go back through time and look at it, that are really the ones that swing series one way or the other. And that's where you really find out where it's going to go. So I agree. Sort of regardless of who wins, we're in a nice spot in all 3 of those series where whoever wins game 3, we're going to have a 2-1 advantage going into game 4. And that's probably my favorite game of any playoff series outside of a game 7 because of just how big that game is.
And Nick, typically when we see game 4, that's when we see the rotations get slashed. That's when we see the coaches start to grip real tight.
Is it possible for Tibbs to grip tighter than how he grips on any other day that ends in Y?
Tibbs is an outlier in this regard.
Oh, in so many ways.
But, you know, Tibbs has got to, you know, look, Tibbs has got to go down there thinking if they come back 2-2, he likes his chances. You know, the Knicks have been a good road team all year in that case. And we'll talk about that series in a second. But Anthony Davis may not have to go for 30 and 20. I mean, that was an extraordinary performance. But he is going to need probably 4 of those type of efforts where he's that involved. And he just didn't deliver it. He's got potentially 5 more chances to do it 3 more times. And if he does, I think the Lakers have a great chance. And, you know, look, if Steph and Clay shoot like this, the series will be over quick. But I don't think that you should react to this. I think say the same thing about the Celtics series. Just because the Celtics bombed the Sixers in game 2 does not mean that they've got it all figured out. And just because the Warriors bombed the Lakers tonight does not mean they have it all figured out. I believe that we're going to have significant, you know, back and forth for the first few games of that series. So let's talk about that series real quick, Bontemps. How do you think Joel looked? It was a very interesting day, a day I've never experienced before in the NBA, where a guy takes the MVP award, has his MVP press conference, does his MVP little media tour on a game day. That's not normal. And does it in a road arena. That's not normal. It was kind of odd to be sitting in the Celtics media room with special Joel Embiid MVP signage up all around. It was just unusual. You know, like he has a shoot around and he comes in like you would talk beyond the shoot around, like, you know, during the course of the season. But this time his post shoot around interview is about winning the MVP. I mean, it was a very unusual day. And then he comes back. What did you think about the way Joel looked? Because I think that's really one of the big factors in the game.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
I thought physically he looked great. He whenever he has to wear a brace or whenever he has to wear a mask, he's always fidgeting with it. He's famously ripped the mask off a couple times. He's always grabbing at the brace. He only really grabbed at it one time in the second quarter in the game. I thought physically he was moving around well. Doc Rivers said today before the Sixers did film that all of their biometric tracking data showed him basically running at his normal speed in the game and kind of playing with the usual force that he plays with. So I thought from that standpoint, it was really encouraging. It was pretty obvious that the Sixers were a little out of sorts. They couldn't really get the ball to where they wanted it to. I think a lot of credit for that goes to Boston. Their perimeter defense was far, far better in game 2 than it was in game 1 for all the reasons we talked about with the Warriors series. So they didn't really let Philly get into anything the whole game. And I think that impacted Joel. But I thought to get the big fella out there, to get him up and running up and down, to get his legs under him going into game 3, to get the rust off in a game that, for all the reasons, again, that we talked about with the Lakers-Warriors series, the Sixers are probably going to lose barring some kind of crazy effort. I thought it made a lot of sense to get him back out there, get the nerves out, get the MVP stuff done, and then get back for game 3.
Yeah, not to interrupt you, but there was a significant pushback, and we were doing TV today, and like, you know, one of the questions in the production meetings was, you know, should Embiid have played? And I got to tell you, like, being around the Sixers, I don't think it was even a question. Like, they absolutely...
No, there was, there was no question at all. When Joel was ready to play, he was going to play. And it being around him as much as I have been, I think it was 100% the right call to get him back out there, because he's a guy who plays himself into shape normally. And he sat out 2 weeks, and you can't have him come back and do the things he does, you know, in game three, if it's 1-1, and have these issues and fall down 2-1 in the series. Like, if he is ready to go, also, he's the MVP of the league. Like, there was some, there were questions after the game about, well, you know, like, how are you going to readjust to playing with Joel Embiid? It's like, Joel Embiid is the MVP of the league.
Right. He's the reason why the Sixers are good. They won 54 games. He played 70 of them. I mean, like, that's why they were there. Like, Nick, if the Sixers are going to win this series, and it would be an upset, okay? The Celtics have now beaten them 4 out of the 6 times they've played. If they're going to win this series and be an upset, it's going to be because of Joel Embiid. You know, it's going to be, and so that's just, I just don't agree with that thinking that they should have, you know, expected James Harden to put up another 40 point game.
Nick, well, you don't think James Harden could beat the Celtics 4 times in a row?
don't get the track started again. I got that coming back at me enough on social media after James' unbelievable game one performance, but no.
By the way, you were right about that. The Sixers, I don't think, would say James Harden would win them 4 games in a row without Joel Embiid. So
the timing wasn't great on all that, but shout out to
Friedel was on Max Kellerman's show. This just in. Was it the day of
game one?
And basically Kellerman was like, you know, Harden could have 40 tonight. And Nick was like, I do not believe that will happen. I think I summarized that for you, Nick.
Yeah. The part that Max had me going on is he said Harden can turn into an offensive juggernaut and carry the Sixers through without Embiid. And I laughed a lot. Now, to Max's credit, at the end, he always has his Max fact. And he said, Harden's going to score 40 tonight and the Sixers are going to win it, which I chuckled at the end of the show too. But the context of that conversation was, can Harden turn back the clock to a point where he's going to start dropping huge numbers again and carry the Sixers without Joel, of which I flatly don't believe. But what I would ask you guys, having lived that series the last few days, is, I came in, my thoughts about Harden aside, having watched what happened at the end of Houston, the end of Brooklyn, and what's happened throughout this season in Philly at times, I just thought the Celtics were so much better. The Sixers could get a game or two. Joel comes back, has a big performance. After 2 games, are you guys swayed at all in the idea that there is a legit path for the Sixers to win this series?
I always thought there was a legit path for the Sixers to win the series. And it's because the Celtics can't get out of their own way. The Celtics should win the championship, probably. If you just look at their team, they have the deepest team. They probably have the most talent. They've been to the finals before. They can play every way in the modern NBA, right? They can run out there with Al Horford and Robert Williams and play 2 bigs. They're going up against a team like the Lakers. If they're playing a smaller team, they play Golden State, say, they can run out Marcus Smart, Derek White, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. They can run a track meet with anybody. They've got Malcolm Brogdon, who's a 50-40-90 guy, basically coming off the bench. They're barely even playing Grant Williams, who's a really good 3-and-D guy. Like, they have the definition of an embarrassment of riches from a depth and talent standpoint. And yet the Celtics mess around all the time. They messed around in the Atlanta series. They messed around in the finals last year. They messed around. I mean, remember we both were at game 7 of the conference finals.
Yep.
They messed around there. Like, they should win this series. They should roll through the conference finals. They will have home court advantage in the NBA finals. They probably should be favored to win the championship. I think they have the shortest odds right now to win the championship. But can the Celtics get out of their own way? And in game 1, they could not. They didn't get up enough threes. They were lackadaisical throughout the game. They should have been up 20 after the first quarter.
They just lost their focus in the fourth quarter offensively, you wouldn't think would happen in a playoff game.
But they lost their focus. They lost that game in the first quarter because they were 17 for 20 in the first quarter. It was a layup line and a dunk line. And they were getting wide open shots. I've never seen a team score easier than the Celtics in that first quarter of game 1. And they were up 5 or 7. After the first quarter, because they just let the Sixers hang around and the game should have been over right then. And that that's just sort of an example of the way they are. So I think Boston should win the series, even at 1-1. I think they've got more depth of talent. They match up well with the Sixers. Embiid is coming back from this injury. But can they actually get it done 3 out of 5 times? That I genuinely don't know if they'll have the focus to do it, because they have not proven capable of doing that all the time.
And the other question is, can Embiid just lift them? Can Embiid have a game where he takes one that they wouldn't have won, or maybe even two? And it's a
can
big
he have
ask,
the Harden but, game, really?
Well, maybe what that's what it is. Did. Maybe that's what it is. I mean, you know, I think it's, and you know, Joel is kind of, he's hedged a little bit on this, because he has made sure to point out to everybody that he should be out 4 to 6 weeks, and that, you know, he came back in two, but he gave his injury report. You know, this is a 4 to 6 week injury. So he is sort of laid the groundwork for the,
he knows exactly what he's doing all the time.
Yes. And I wouldn't be surprised if he mentions the 4 to 6 week number again, just in case you miss it the first time.
I suspect it will be mentioned after every game, the rest of the playoffs, no matter how long they go.
He came out last night after the game and said, there's no excuses. But by the way, I was supposed to be out 4 to 6 weeks.
Yes. That those two answers will happen after every single game.
Right. Okay. So that's what Joel does. But Joel's also a brilliant player, and it's possible he has a performance or two that elevates them. It's why he won the MVP, because we saw him do it regularly.
Well, and look, we haven't even talked about Denver and Phoenix yet, right? But we spent the last couple of years talking about Joel Embiid and Nikola Jokic so much, and whether you can win a championship with a true center in the modern NBA. And you know what? For both of those guys, it is sitting right there. Like, Denver has to win this series with Phoenix. It will be a catastrophe at this point, frankly, if they do not. Chris Paul's hurt. They've got a 2-0 lead. They absolutely have to win that series as the number one seed. They're going to have home court advantage in the West Finals. Like, this is their chance. This is Jokic's chance to break through and win. And it's the same thing with Joel. I agree that they're underdogs in the series. The same time, they've got home court advantage. He's getting the MVP on Friday night. He's back healthy. As he said, no excuses. I'm on the court. Like, to your point, Nick, can Joel Embiid lift these guys up? Can he have 2 or 3 monster games and get these guys through this series? Because if he does, they're going to be significant favorites to make the NBA Finals. And he's got a chance to do all the stuff that he's talked for years about wanting to do. So for both of those guys, it's the same question. Can they take advantage of this opportunity? Because both of them may not have a better one than they've got right now.
All right. One other thing, Jason Tatum, he had 38, I think, in game one, but he was not effective when they needed him to be in the fourth quarter. Jason Tatum is on the cusp of superstardom. Maybe people would already agree he's there, but if it's going to be the Celtics doing this, and by the way, he's shown he can do this before. It's not like he hasn't shown it, but, like, you know, they need him. And in game two, he laid an egg. He was 1 of 7. He got in foul trouble. Now, he didn't play down the stretch because they opened up a big lead without him in the third quarter. Jason Tatum should be pretty pleased with the way last night went, because had they been in trouble in that game, he'd have been on the line, because he was not delivering. But it is now incumbent on Tatum to deliver a game in Philly. And it doesn't have to be game three. It could be game four. And I've seen him do it before. And, you know, Jaylen Brown has played pretty well in the couple of games in the series. They stopped letting him shoot for some reason, or he stopped shooting in game one after a great start. But it was a little bit better.
Fantastic in game two.
So, yeah, he was the best player on the floor in game two. So it doesn't have to be Tatum, but I suspect that it's going to come down to something that Tatum can do. We all know he can do it. So that we are setting up to have a good weekend in Philadelphia. Bontemps and I go into games 3 and 5. Okay, Nick, I want to talk about your series with the Knicks and the Heat. I feel like this series is going to be determined by the health of Julius Randle versus the health of Jimmy Butler. Butler out, Randle in, the score changed. I know that Brunson had a huge second half. You wrote a really good story about Brunson kind of having to give himself a pep talk, because he said he was feeling sorry for himself because of how he didn't play great in the first game and a half. Obviously, and like, by the way, being in New York right now, I'm, you know, running into all these people on the street and at LaGuardia and other places who just instantly want to talk about Knicks and the love of Jalen Brunson. You know, Nick and I had dinner tonight. This guy came up at dinner And he was just want to talk about Jalen Brunson.
B, come on now. You're burying the lead of this whole story. Timmy B, we're sitting at dinner. We're in the middle of a conversation. And this kid walks up and he's like, Ryan, oh my gosh.
He was like a 30-year-old.
Well, okay. This 30-year-old comes up. Brian, I'm a huge fan. Has not a clue who I am. Fine. I mean, that's happened everywhere I go with me.
Sure.
In several countries. We're in Dublin last summer. These people walk up, Brian Roydors. Oh my gosh. Not a clue. Hey, that's cool. But the part that really had me cracked up, if you can believe it, is this 30-year-old dude who was very kind. And
he's probably like 24. And if he hears this, he's like, oh my God, I look old.
This dude is like, can I get a picture? Again, not a clue who I am, just hands me the phone. I'm like, here, random dude sitting at the table with Ryan Windhorst, take this picture. And I'm like, absolutely.
That so wasn't the point pictures. Of the story.
And it was unbelievable because it was just like, oh, man, this is my guy. This is my guy, B.
Well, Nick, next time someone asks you to take a picture of me, hold the phone up high. You don't take a shot coming up my nose.
I feel height like I'm talking to Timmy light. B's wife, Kelly, right now. She kills me every time I take a picture.
Height and light, okay?
Height and light. I know it. There you go.
Okay. Well, we didn't have great light, and we sure as heck didn't have height. Okay, that wasn't the point. The point is, I was still wearing.
Got to take care of the. You got to take care of the star, Nick. That's really the star. Got to take care of the star.
Absolutely. I was still wearing
I'm an
makeup
Instagram from... boyfriend at this point. That's
right. I was still wearing my makeup from being in the studio, so luckily that was fine. So my point is everybody's going goo goo gaga here about Jalen Brunson, and I get it. But I don't know, Nick, if this is going to come down to Brunson or if it's come down to Jimmy and Julius Randle's health.
The difference to me early on in this series, B, compared to where the Knicks were throughout that time against Cleveland, Cleveland wilted in games 3 and 4, and Timmy B was sitting right next to me, more than any team I've ever seen in a pressurized environment. That team walked into the Garden. It was roaring. They needed to make shots late, especially in game 4. It just didn't happen.
They were not Miami, ready.
They weren't ready. They're young. You know, we could go through the reasons, but they were completely shook by what happened in the Garden.
You know who was ready for game 1? Miami. Miami was ready.
Well, and there's the difference. Miami, late in that game, never wavered at all. Jimmy rolls his ankle. He hangs in there because, of course, the Knicks didn't do a good job at all going at him. He could barely move, but he was out there. But they've got guys. Kyle Lowry, Bam Adebayo. The list goes on and on with Spoelstra. Knowing how to handle everything that was coming at them. So right away, that's the difference, is the Knicks can't just go, oh, well, this team, they're young and they're weak. Let's just push them over. But as far as the rest of the series goes, the other thing to add in, B, is Brunson's ankle's giving him trouble too. I don't think there's any question at all that he will be out there. He will find a way. Randle said
he's also dealing with a thumb thing he's been dealing with for a while.
That's been messed up and his hand. But Randle said it after Thursday's practice. When he was talking about being ready for game 2, he said, there was no way I was missing that game. I am sure Brunson feels the exact same way. The issue to me is who is going to be able to create more offensively late. If Jimmy comes back, okay. But if Jimmy can't be Jimmy Butler late in those games, there's not too many other places for Miami to turn. The Knicks have Brunson. They have Randle. Hart has hit some big shots for them coming down the stretch in some of these moments. And RJ Barrett, at least in that last series, has the feel of being okay to create and make some shots of his own. But it was a rock fight in game 2. And to me, if Jimmy comes back and he looks like Jimmy Butler, that confidence will be able to carry a Heat team that coming into this series, I wasn't sure if they had enough to begin with.
Eric Spoelstra's one of his favorite things to say is we have enough. You know, last year during
else says that too. His name's Tom Thibodeau. Well, we have more than enough.
Right. Well, they learned from the same guy, did they not?
Absolutely.
He's the godfather. I remember last year in the conference finals, Jimmy Butler was awesome. And then he tweaked his knee or hurt his knee. And then he came and he played in games 4 and 5, but he just wasn't himself. And it kind of looked like curtains. And then he came out in game 6 with one of the great playoff games I've ever seen. Now, I have seen many, many ankle injuries. That did not look like a one-game ankle injury to me. Having said that, I would not be surprised at all if Jimmy plays. The question is, we know he's probably going to try to play through it. Will he be effective? I mean, the longer the series goes, probably the better he's going to get. I also, without putting anything past him, he could come back on Saturday and he could score 35. I wouldn't expect it, but I wouldn't put it past him. So again, I feel like the Heat will probably get game 3. Actually, I don't know if I can say that because I don't know about Jimmy. So I don't feel as good about that. But I think if you come out of there 2-2, I think the Knicks will be in okay stead. But Jimmy's health is important.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All right. Before we go, I wanted to talk about the kind of the big transaction happened in the NBA today. Mike Budenholzer being let go by the Milwaukee Bucks. Not often that you see the team with the best regular season record fire their coach, but it has happened before. I've seen it. I remember Mike Brown being fired when he had the number one overall seed in 2010 when the Cavs were upset in the second round.
Not often the one seed with the best record in the league loses to an eight seed in the first round either.
It's happened a handful of times. The tactical stuff that Bud did in that series was hard to get past. And as you've talked about before, Bontemps, Bud is Bud. And while they've maybe updated the app a few times, Bud is pretty much Bud. They did alter their three-point defensive strategy mildly this year, and it did serve them well. But if you don't like the way Bud is going to operate, then you're probably going to have to move on from him because he's not really going to change. And the tactics didn't work. And the Bucks have a very challenging summer coming up in front of them, Bontemps.
Yeah. I mean, look, when you lose, like the Bucks lost in the first round, there is going to be at least one fall person and there might be more. And Mike Budenholzer is a guy who, let's be honest, if the Bucks had lost to the Nets a couple of years ago, Kevin Durant's foot was a few inches farther back, or if they just lose in overtime in that game 7 in the second round, he would have been fired then. Like he wasn't going to make it to the next season at that point if he didn't win that series. So, you know, it's obviously he went on to win that championship and did a great job getting the Bucks over the line that year. But this is not a guy who, you know, has been, you know, fully comfortable in this job for a while. And again, the way that series went, there was going to be some fall people. And now you look at a summer ahead for the Bucks where, like you said, you have, as you've talked about a couple of different times, you've got the looming situation of Giannis Antetokounmpo having the ability to extend his contract in September. And is he going to be interested in doing that? You have Chris Middleton with a player option on his contract. What is he going to do? You have Brooke Lopez heading into unrestricted free agency. What is he going to do? You have Drew Holiday, who has 1 year left on his deal before he can be a free agent. He can extend, I think, in February. What is he going to do? And then they've got Jay Crowder, Joe Ingles, Wesley Matthews, all his free agents. What are they going to do with them? So they have a ton of questions to answer, and they're staring at this looming, you know, tax situation with the new CBA. The second apron is going to be an issue. Like they have a very, very complicated road ahead. And now part of it is going to be deciding who's going to be the coach of the team.
Well, the problem is there's a chicken and egg thing here. So first off, you're going to have to probably decide on the coach. And the coach, the quality of coach that you're going to get, you obviously it's a crucial point, but is a coach willing to, is a high level coach willing to come there? if there's uncertainty about Giannis. Okay. So you have the coaching decision, and then you have the decision on Lopez and Chris Middleton, because Giannis can't extend until September. Like, no matter what, even if they had gone to the finals and they had won 4-0 by 20 points each game.
But even if he wants to extend, he can't extend until then because of the rules.
Right. So like, ideally you want to know what's going on with Giannis, and then you let that inform your rest of your decisions. And I mean, Giannis may give them some indication, but why would he, you know?
Well, and as we've talked about before, go back to when he signed the Supermax. He signed the Supermax after they traded for Jrue Holiday. So there was a chicken and egg thing there too. They knew if they got Jrue Holiday, he would stay. They got Jrue Holiday and he stayed.
Right. So it's going to be hard for the team without having the greatest feel for Giannis's decision to then make these other huge decisions, which if you sign two guys in their 30s to medium to long-term contracts, and then you don't get the extension from Giannis, you put yourself in real jeopardy, especially because of the way the new rules limit your team building. But let me just say this. When Kareem Abdul-Jabbar asked to be traded from the Bucks in 1973, I think it was, this is a non-renewable
resource. It was a couple years later. It was 75, but still, oh, 75. Same difference. Okay. Same difference.
Okay, then you get back for 45 years. Giannis is a non-renewable resource. So this is what I remember having these conversations with in Cleveland about LeBron. You know, and it was not really comparable because LeBron was older, but like, yeah, the Cavs traded everything. And, you know, the one thing that helped grease the skids out of LeBron, out of Cleveland, was the trade where they took the draft pick for Kyrie instead of taking, you know, more ready players. And the ready player that they got was Isaiah Thomas, who they quickly learned was injured. Career defining injury, unfortunately. And so, but they traded everything else. And it still wasn't enough, and LeBron was still annoyed. So, like, I would just say, before people start making assumptions and before the Bucks are like, man, we can't give Brooke Lopez, blah, 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 just understand that if you don't exhaust every situation with Giannis, that you may regret it. Yeah, if you decide to do something, you may be in a better position to rebuild someday in the short term, but you're not going to probably get another player like that back. So I would do everything I possibly could to keep him there, Nick. And we have a new owner with the Bucks, and we also have a governor change. When Jimmy Haslam bought out Mark Lazary, the governorship, the guy who made the prime decision-making, shifted to Wes Edens, who was their previous governor. And so I think it's a little bit, I don't think we should make assumptions about what the Bucks are going to do.
I've talked to Giannis about this several times over the years, and he has said repeatedly that all he wants is to be one of those guys who plays with the same team forever. The Stephs, the Dirks, Jerry West, Reggie Miller, Kobe. He wants that, but that was a few years ago. Do we think that Giannis is at a point now in his own career where he says, you know, I just don't think the future is as bright in Milwaukee. There's this coaching change. We don't know who's going to land in there. That it's a legitimate possibility now for the Bucks to consider. And this speaks to exactly your point, B, that they could exhaust everything possible, but there's still a chance that he ends up walking away from the only team he's known.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far ahead of them of ourselves. I just think there's thunderclouds on the horizon, and
it ties into everything, though. I mean, that question, as is always the case with a superstar of Giannis's caliber, hangs over every single decision now moving forward.
I also just want to say, with the player movement that happens and the various rules, it's hard to keep a team together for 6 to 10 years like it was before.
And now it's become that much harder with these new rules. These new rules are designed to break teams up. That's
the thing about the new rules, this quote, so called second apron, which the Bucks are going to be headed for. If you have that second apron, it buries you. You can't sign anybody. You can't really trade for anybody. Your draft picks are automatically kicked to the back of the first round. Like, it is a target on the Clippers, Lakers, and at least the Nets when they started negotiating it. The Nets have since broken down, but like it is an absolute target to keep these teams from being able to maneuver. And that's what the Bucks are potentially facing here, is they are facing the fallout of like the Warriors winning the title and the Nets and the Clippers paying so much money in luxury tax. So I still think it's a very attractive job, because why wouldn't you want to coach Giannis? You know, you're going to walk in and have a chance to coach a playoff team or to coach a championship contender. But I do think it's a question that if you're a high profile coach — I'm not going to throw any names because I don't want to be, but if you're a high profile coach who's either available or could become available, these are questions you're going to have.
Well, your first two questions are, what are you doing with Chris Middleton? And what are you doing with Brooke Lopez? Those are if you're interviewing with Milwaukee, those are the first two questions you have. Are you guys going to keep Brooke Lopez? Are you going to keep Chris Middleton? How are you going to build out the rest of the roster? Are you going to go over the second apron? Are like these are questions that they need to answer, because the answer to any of those questions is no, but we're not sure. Like that's not an answer I'm going to want to hear if I'm a coach looking at that job.
But you think that's going to stop some coach from saying, "Hey, I still want to coach Giannis and try to
win." I don't know what's going to go through the mind of anybody interviewing for that job. I'm just saying, to me, if I'm walking in there, if I'm any coach and I'm walking in to that job right now, and I sit down with Wes Edens and Jimmy Haslam and John Horse, the general manager, the first questions I'm asking are, what are you doing with Chris Middleton and what are you doing with Brooke Lopez? Because to me, that informs what direction the team is going in. Because if you're paying those guys, you're trying to keep them, then you're trying to run it back with the team that was the best team in the league this year, that had a very bizarre first round series. Miami hit a trillion threes. Giannis was hurt. A couple fluke collapses in the fourth quarter. Like, you could very easily walk in that job and say, "Hey, I'm a favorite to win the title next year if I'm coaching this team and I have this team back." But am I going to have this?
Is this team coming back? Yeah,
right. That's right. That's the question. If you could say to a coach, you're going to have basically that starting group and some depth pieces back next year, I think a ton of people are interested in that job. If it's like, well, we don't know what we're going to do, we have to figure it out, we're not sure how it's going to look, then that's a lot different. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
All right. You mentioned earlier, before we go, actually, Bontemps, you mentioned earlier about the Suns Nuggets. Suns down 2-0, Nuggets up 2-0. Chris Paul almost certainly going to be out Friday, probably also out Sunday for game 4. They just don't have much depth. You have, since they did the trade, you have been critical that you didn't think the Suns had enough. That certainly looks like the case the first two games. I'm not ready to go there yet. Certainly, I recognize Denver has become the complete driver's seat in this series, especially since they're so good at home and they've been so good in the clutch. And they look good. This is the last few games are the best they've looked in a while. I suspect you will see the ball more in Durant's hands. One of the things that's happened with this team, they've had a lot of success initially with Durant, even though it was spread out and not really against top level opponents. I mean, even Kevin said that when they finished off the Clippers in the last round, Kevin openly said, "Look, we've been lucky. We haven't played teams that are whole, either in the regular season or the playoffs." And now they're playing a team that's whole and they're suffering, but they haven't, you know, in my view, done a good enough job to feature Durant. They have basically featured Booker and made Durant the floor spacer, secondary option. And the thing is, it worked. They won a lot of games. They put up great offensive numbers, and Booker was explosive. He was putting up, he had an absolutely jaw dropping first round series, basically because the Clippers were standing on Durant's toes and he just exploited it. I don't think if you're the Suns, you can go out with Durant being the floor spacer, especially if you don't have Chris Paul. I think the ball ends up more in Durant's hands. They've had 3 days of practice, knowing that they're probably not going to have Chris Paul for the weekend. I think you see, if they're going to go down, I think you see the ball. I think you see Kevin more involved, Nick. And that's a guy that you saw in 2021 playing that role when Kyrie Irving got hurt, that was extraordinarily effective. I know, almost beat the Bucks, as we have talked about.
And he can do it. If ever there was a moment for the Kevin game to put this team back on track, this is it right now. It's got to happen. But this goes to what Timmy B has been telling the two of us since the moment that deal went down, B, which is Kevin's incredible. Booker is really, really good, but they just don't have enough behind those two guys. And as this series has opened up, it seems more obvious than ever. And people always love to jump on Kevin. Oh, KD can do more. But, you know, this is on Matt Ishbia. This is on the owner. If you want to be upset as a Suns fan at why this team potentially could go down in the second round to a really good Nuggets team, it's because he made the deal because he wanted to make a splash. And, guys, if I was in the same position, I would have made that deal too. I wanted Kevin Durant.
Well, you know, Ishbia is going to spend a lot of tax money in the next year or two to potentially build the team out. So I don't.
But the second say it's just you get failure. Kevin, Tim Legler made this point the other day on Max Kellerman's show. The second you get Kevin, your window is open, and you better do it now. Maybe it happens in another year, and they can and refill the roster with some better players, especially bench wise, but. You get Kevin Durant, you got to win now. And you're on the verge, if you're Phoenix, of blowing one of these opportunities that you made that deal for. So there are always a lot of layers in team building. That front office just did not want to give up Mikal Bridges. They did. The deal went down, but they just don't look like a team that is close to being complete enough to think that not only are they going to turn around this series, but over the summer, it'll get back to a point where we say, hey, Phoenix can go all the way again.
You know how many points have been scored by players not named Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, Chris Paul, and DeAndre Ayton for the Suns in this series through two games? I don't know the total number of points. Got a guess.
I heard the number earlier today, so I'm going to refrain.
32. Oh. 32. There were six scored in game two. The reason I would say the Suns are not blowing this opportunity is because they just are not good enough. They don't have the horses to do it because, and this is why you don't see teams win when they make these trades in the middle of the season, because they don't have enough. And again, I will go back to everybody just dismissed the fact that this team played no one. And when Kevin Durant, A, barely played, and B, they played nobody the whole time he was there till the playoffs. Everyone said, well, they got Kevin Durant. It's going to be fine. They're going to be great. And they've been in close games in these playoffs, and it hasn't looked great. And it's not because those guys aren't good. It's not because they can't figure it out. It's because they haven't been in any situations like this yet. And they're playing a Denver team. Like, look at fourth quarter of game two. Yes, Chris Paul got hurt, and it sucked to see him walk off again from a playoff game with an injury. That was brutal to see, though, with the number of minutes he was playing. Again, it's not exactly a shock he would get hurt. But the Denver Nuggets have a core group of players that have been together for hundreds of games now, over several years, and have been to the conference finals and have been in the playoffs and have played together. Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic know where they are every second they're on the court, right? They're in a basically tie game in the fourth quarter with the Suns. They just run away from the Suns in the fourth quarter. It's not a coincidence that happened. It's not a coincidence that the Suns put that game away, even though Jamal Murray had an awful game, because they have been in those situations before more times than they can count, and they know where their guys are going to be, and they know exactly what they're doing. And the Suns just don't. You combine that with the fact that they don't have any depth, and now they don't have Chris Paul. Again, Devin Booker and Kevin Durant combined to score 59 points in game two on 56 shots. Like, they can't take 56 shots every game for five games and win four of them. But they don't have a choice because they don't have anybody else who could score. So, like, this is the conundrum that they're in. I mean, maybe they can come back. Kevin is incredible. Him and Devin are great players. Obviously, you shouldn't rule anybody out in the NBA playoffs, as we've seen. But it's just very hard to me, logically, to construct an argument as to how they're going to win this series unless something crazy happens to Denver.
Well, we will see. I agree that the Nuggets are in driver's seat, but I don't think it's over yet. So we'll see.
It's
mostly because of Durant that I believe in. Go ahead.
I agree with you on Kevin completely, having watched it he has that ability still within him. Yeah,
he and Devin are both. I mean, Devin's been unbelievable in these playoffs. They're both great.
I bring everything full circle in this regard. In listening to our conversation, it sounds like we all believe that Denver is now not only in the driver's seat, but probably is going to finish off this series at some point. I think we all believe that Golden State still has the momentum to close
No, we don't.
You're
all
believe with the Lakers now?
No. I didn't say me. I said we all don't. That's roster. Right. Mr. Top Six Roster's on the pod here, buddy. Mr. Top Six Roster.
I think if you're going to get credit for being right about the Suns, I think you can give me credit for being calling the Lakers as being a formidable team. I told you, I think the Lakers will go up 2-1, and then whoever wins game four will tell us a lot. So that's what I'm going to wait and see what happens.
I feel like,
we have a prediction from Brian Windhorst, which never happens, folks. He's predicted a Sixers win on Friday, and he's predicted a Lakers win on Saturday. Big day on the pod. We have real predictions.
I'm in the middle of a fight between
two
of my brothers.
There's no fights. But Brian's been correct on the Lakers turning into a formidable team. There's no question. They're tied 1-1 in the conference semifinals. But back to your point, Nick.
The point still is we're not feeling good about Phoenix on the whole. Denver looks great. All three of us, in theory, agree, okay, Golden State has maybe a slight edge still going into game three. And then I think we all agree Boston, if they can stop playing with their food, to use Doc's quote from the last round.
Well, that wasn't exactly Doc's quote.
They can roll over Philly. As we sit here right now going into game three in Miami, who are we leaning towards in this Knicks Heat series? Because for me, with all the uncertainty around Jimmy and with the fact that there just aren't a lot of other options on that Heat team, as rough as the Knicks have looked at times in the series, I would still take the Knicks right now to finish.
Yeah. 1-1 to 8, the Knicks have a better team, but the Heat's one is more powerful if he's healthy. That's my opinion. And so we'll see what the Heat's one's got.
He asked you to lean one way or the other. What is your lean?
I got to see how Jimmy looks. Why is that making me a bad person?
Again,
just give your answer, Timmy Bond.
I went into the series thinking the Knicks would win a long series because for as great as Jimmy is and has been in these playoffs, the Knicks beat them 3 out of 4 times in the regular season. I like the matchup for them. You saw Julius get off in game two. It's a lot different than going up against Evan Mobley inside. And I think as long as the Knicks can hit some shots, one of the weird things in the playoffs has been Emmanuel Quickley has been terrible for the Knicks. One of the most important players in the regular season. He has basically been a zero in the playoffs. You told me that was the case and the Knicks would be 1-1 in the second round. I'd have been pretty surprised. So at some point, it'd be nice for them if he gets going. But again, with the uncertainty around Jimmy, with the matchup advantages I think the Knicks have overall, it's a slight lean for the Knicks. But I think we've learned over the past couple of years, you bet against Jimmy and you bet against Spo at your own peril. So it will be very interesting to see how that goes.
All right, Nick, thanks for pinch hitting for McMahon, who's probably sleeping on the plane right now, and hope he gets in safe. Thank you to Bontemps. We're going to travel up and back to Philadelphia together, Friedel. I don't know how it's going to go. We'll see. I could get thrown out of the car on 95 afternoon.
No chance.
All right. Thank you to Jackson, who didn't have to stay up this late. So thank you. And we will talk to you on Monday. Who knows what will happen over the weekend. Enjoy it.
Adios, amigos.